244, Chapter 25 of Dracula.
Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 244, The Winds of Change. This week's episode is brought to you by Knit Circus, the e-newsletter that can arrive in your mailbox delivering three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can sign up at www.knitcircus.com. Also, Cool for Cats, the new novel by Andrew C. Ordover. You can get it at amazon.com or find out more from the link in the show notes. And of course, we're still working to increase the ways that you can listen to Craftlit on the go or wherever you happen to be. Right now, you can listen free to the most recent episodes at Stitcher Radio, an app you can download for free onto whatever kind of mobile device you like to use. So hello! It's good to be here on what is proving to kick into being a very windy Friday here. So I actually named the podcast The Winds of Change because that's what's happening in the book, but also because that's what's happening outside. And, you know, if it gets any better, you're probably going to be able to hear the wind a little bit in the background, which is kind of creepy, but there it is. So, hi. I hope you had a great week. I had an okay one. I had one night where I didn't sleep at all. But now that I'm checking with other people didn't sleep much either that night. So perhaps it was something in the air. A zeitgeist, perhaps. People are starting to notice that not only did we start the Dracula zeitgeist, which we did, but Gulliver's Travels is now also going to kick in to being a zeitgeist as well. I'm happy with being the forerunner. You know, the snowplow at the front of the herd. I don't mind that. But you know, it would be so nice if somebody like Learn Out Loud would acknowledge the zeitgeist started with us. Wouldn't that be nice? I swear, you know, there's all these online places, and the bigger they get, the faster they seem to forget where they started. And in the beginning, there were a lot of these kind of podcasts that were like this. You know, they're done at home. I am by no means a professional, although I think the podcast has gotten better over time. I've certainly learned more about audio and how not to have weird creaking sounds and stuff on the audio. But if the only thing you're ever going to talk about is professionally produced NPR shows, well, that's kind of leaving out so much good stuff that's out there. This week, I was listening actually to Julie over at Forgotten Classics. She was on a podcast for SFF Audio a while ago where they talked about Gulliver's Travels. And I listened. It was a very, very interesting discussion. And there are things that they saw in the book that I didn't. But there are also things that they saw in the book that I did, and that made me feel really good about doing Gulliver next. I'm very excited. So, I don't know. Maybe we should have a letter-writing campaign to Learn Out Loud to say, hey, there's this podcast called Craftlit, or Just the Books. Actually, I think Julie is listening to Just the Books these days because she doesn't have enough time to listen to the Crafty Chat. And today there won't be much of that because I have been designing and knitting my little heart out. You know what I pulled out? You're going to laugh at me, so prepare yourself for a good belly laugh. I pulled out the Vogue 2002 Map of the World Afghan. It had to happen, right? Because I'm now in a colder climate. And sadly, there haven't been those long snowy days that I was hoping to have where I could just sit and work on the blooming Afghan. But in the spirit of having made this big move, I pulled it out anyway, and it was nice to work on. It's actually in much better shape than I thought. I don't have that much more to do. I have one complete panel to do, but not very much left on the the end of the second. I just have to do the little tabby bits on the second, and then the top third of the third panel. There will be pictures of the panels. I just have to finish those little tabby bits, and then I'll block what I've got and take pictures of it, because it really is going to be quite impressive. I am very excited about that. I also completed the hat, the hair clip hat pattern that I was working on, that has the steeked back so that you can button it up around your hair clip or ponytail, should you desire it. And I'm very happy with that. That is actually for sale. That one comes with instructions on steeking and lots of in-process pictures. So if you've never steeked before, this might be a really good time for you to try it. Not only that, but because it is a steeking pattern, like there's no other way to do it that isn't hugely time consuming. Steeking actually makes it go very quickly. If you've never steeked before, but you've been intrigued, this might be a good pattern because I designed it specifically to work with cheap yarn from Michaels and still get you an attractive hat at the end. And, you know, it's the hat is not going to get all that much wear and tear. It's not like a sweater where the sleeves are going to rub against each other and you're going to wind up with pilling yarn everywhere. This is a very simple bonnet pattern, actually. So I thought, well, maybe those of you who've never steeked before, you know, get out the pattern, get out your yarn and needles, get out the bottle of scotch, because you're going to need it for when you have to cut your knitting. But you could easily make one of these hats in 2 nights of TV knitting. It's that easy. Well, maybe 3 nights of TV knitting. And I made the pattern twice, and what I found was I could knit the hat pretty much entirely with maybe just a couple inches to spare, maybe an inch. And I did that in one night, and then I finished it off, finished the I-cord border, and did the steek the next night. And then the button placket for the steeked part, that took another night usually, not a full night. So that's not too bad. I mean, that's faster than a pair of socks, and it's way faster than a sweater, and it lets you wear a hair clip. I'm wearing mine today when I go outside to pick up the boys, so I'm excited. A lot of you also went over and gave little hearts to Meg's new pattern, the Game of Thrones gauntlets. They are gorgeous. Her mittens always are. She does a beautiful job. And she links from the pattern, she links to instructions on how to do the plaited edge. Now, this is the same plaited edge that I used in the knitting socks from around the world, Pivotar. I don't know if I said that right. Socks, the Finnish socks that are on the cover of the book. There's a plaited cast on for that. And that's actually the class that I taught in Tucson at Christmas time, was how to do that kind of plaited border. And it's loads of fun to do. Once you see how it works, it's really genius. And it is a cast on you will want to use more often. And it turns out to be really useful for socks, because it's not super springy like a ribbed cast on would be, but it has stretch. And on the gauntlets, it just looks beautiful. So we're gearing up here. I know you're going to cringe. We're gearing up here to move. We have to find another place. We've lived in a very small apartment with all four of us for a year, and it's been okay. But we really need to find a better place. And so if any of you know of anyone who is looking to rent or doing a rent-to-own or anything like that in the area, I don't think we can buy anything because we had to do the short sale in Arizona, and so our credit got, you know, trounced by the economy. So I don't imagine that we're going to be able to buy, but we're very good renters. We keep care of property. So I'm on the hunt for that, which is loads of fun, and working on Defarge number 2, editing all the stuff and getting it ready, and it's so exciting. And that leads me to remind you that the next 3 books are Defarge Does Shakespeare, Defarge Does Chaucer, and Defarge Does Sherlock. And these 3 books are the same idea. Patterns based on characters or events or anything from, in this case, Shakespeare plays or sonnets. Chaucer stories and Sherlock Holmes stories. And, you know, let your imagination run wild. There is a link on the show notes to a page that will tell you how to submit. And right now, since I'm working on Defarge 2, it's kind of open in that an email with photographs of scans of sketches or swatches and fairly detailed descriptions will be just fine as a submission. You don't have to send me a swatch or anything like that. This is one of those places where Ravelry really turns out to be useful for me as the book editor, because I can go on Ravelry and I can look at your knitting. So you don't have to go through such a formal process on these upcoming books. It's pretty easy for me to be able to see what you can do. So my husband, who I love, who wrote a lovely post about our older son having kind of the first round of growing pains, as he is firmly into the tween world and he's, you know, heading towards being a teenager, which is shocking, but I guess not a surprise. We had to know it was coming. My husband wrote a really beautiful blog post on being an outsider, which, since we were talking about Stoker being an outsider looking in, I thought you might be interested in. So I put a link from the show notes to his blog post, which really is just heartbreaking and lovely. But he also left me a comic this morning on the table. This is Sally Forth. And it shows the husband saying, "Okay, any ideas about a fun hobby we can do as a family?" And the mom says, "What about knitting? It's fun, relaxing, and clears the head." And the husband says, "Sal, do you know what the guys at work would say if they found out I'm knitting?" And she says, "How would they find out?" And he said, "Well, I'm not going to spend all that time making a scarf not to show it off." Perhaps that is why I can't get my husband to knit. But you know who does knit? Dracula. Okay, I'm totally joking about that, but I thought that was hilarious as a segue. So there it is. Dracula, knitter. No. We have a very interesting chapter. It is very much the winds of change for our chapter today. And things get moving along. We really only have 4 more chapters left, 25, 26, 3 more chapters, 25, 26, 27. Dude, it's almost the end of the book. I don't know how I feel about leaving Dracula behind. I've enjoyed it so much. All right, well, anyway, I have an email for you from the Reverend Renee Rico, who we have heard from before, but she said she wanted to mention about, Mina's said it a couple of times before, but last week we really got it a lot. Mina's declaration that she's impure, like when she was touched by the host and it seared her forehead. She said there are a few other things to consider layered upon this. One is biblical. In the Jewish tradition of the biblical era, not the modern, but the biblical era, many, many things could cause one to be impure, including sickness and eating food not declared kosher, and even menstruation was cause for considering someone impure. In such cases, the only way to become clean was to go before the rabbis. Now, the corollary to all this, which I'm throwing in, is there's also the ritual bath, the mikveh, where you submerge yourself, and it's very much a ritual, how you clean yourself before going into the bath, how you submerge yourself in the water fully is very specific. There are many rules to follow, but at the end of it, you have been cleansed. Okay, so that goes way back. This is not a baptism. This is a mikveh, not to be confused with a mitzvah. If one remained impure, even touching another person could render the other person impure ritually. And of course, blood itself had to be handled very carefully because blood outside the body also made one impure. So then there's the second part, which is the honor-shame culture. The operating system is of female honor, and if a woman was violated, then the whole family experienced the shame. Now, Renee says, I think the system operated in the Victorian era, and I agree to some extent. But we hear so much about honor-shame cultures nowadays with... like there's a documentary out about women in Iraq, I think, who had their family throw acid on them because they were considered impure. That kind of extreme discussion of honor shame instances in modern culture, I think, take on a completely different resonance. I think that Renee's right. In the Victorian era, there was certainly, you know, a fallen woman brought shame on her own whole family. And if you are watching Downton Abbey at all, what Mary has gone through and is continuing to go through, I think fairly represents kind of the conversations that would be going on behind closed doors within the family. She says, though, and I think this is interesting, Stoker seems to be taking a much more modern take on the violation of Mina by having the men both rescue and work to redeem her from her state of shame. And that's an interesting point. It would have been very, very easy for Mina to have been shunned because of this. And perhaps it's because the men truly understand the danger of Dracula, and because Dracula is who he is, there is no way that Mina could have resisted him. I mean, there's the whole part of you have to open the door for the vampire to come in, but we also know that Dracula can control people psychically. So how much of that is free will and how much of that is being compelled by an outside force? It's interesting that when there is no way to blame the victim, the men really step up. She goes on and says, there's also the notion of demon possession connected with impurity. In the Bible, Jesus and his disciples have the capacity to cast out demons, and they often blurt out the truth in Jesus' presence, much as Mina cries out when the host touches her forehead. She receives a scar, which would have made her ritually impure under the Old Testament traditions, even without the possession. With it, it is a double whammy, and in the New Testament world, exorcism would be needed. Interesting. So there's also been some really interesting discussion going on the comment section of the website about Stoker knowing that he was making the men kind of ridiculous for having left Mina out and in the process setting Mina up to be taken by Dracula. One of the comments that I thought nailed it is for Stoker's audience at the time, he would have had less explaining to do for having the men keeping Mina out of the conversations than he would have had if he'd gone the other way. He would have wound up having to come up with excuses and make some kind of justification for keeping Mina in the discussions. And it hadn't occurred to me how simple and straightforward that point of view is, that for Stoker's day, he may have been ahead of his time, but the rest of his reading audience wasn't. And I'm sure she's right that when people back then read it and they get to the part where Van Helsing and Seward are like, you know, well, she could still have children and you don't want to scar her. And, you know, they didn't even know if she was pregnant at the time, all of that stuff. Everybody's going to be nodding going, oh, right. Thank God you guys are keeping her out of there. That's really good. It's only in the modern world where we go, meh. And you're going to get more of that kind of stuff in Gulliver's Travels. And Gulliver's Travels is interesting because it is way older than Dracula. There is nothing modern about the world that Jonathan Swift lived in. The only thing modern is the way his brain works, which is kind of cool. Okay, in Dracula today, I have a few things that are interesting and a few things that I'm going to actually read to you in their entirety after the narrative. I don't think not knowing them in advance will in any way hurt your appreciation of the text. First off, I want you to know that the Orient Express did actually exist at this point, and it only started being called the Orient Express in 1891. So that's absolutely accurate. You will hear some statements in the chapter today that blatantly contradict things that you already know to be true. Just let it go. There may be reasons that you don't know of. So don't get hung up on it. There will also be some major melodrama. Again, if you can just work your way through it and let it roll off your back, it'll be so much better. Also, while this is all one chapter, it's actually taking place over a much larger period of time. The first journal entry that we get is from the 11th of October. And the second, there's an enormous break during travel time, and it's the 15th of October. So just don't let it jar you, because if you're not paying attention to the dates really closely, it's very surprising. If you've ever heard the word hodgepodge, which I use all the time, evidently it comes from a legal statement. It's a hodgepot, H-O-T-C-H-P-O-T. It means the blending or gathering together of properties for the purpose of securing equality in division, especially as practiced in certain cases in the distribution of property of an intestate parent. So there. At one point, Seward is going to comment and use the phrase transcendentalism. Now, just as a reminder, or if you weren't listening through Little Women, transcendentalism, 19th century movement of American writers and philosophers who generally believed in the essential unity of all creation, the innate goodness of man, and the supremacy of insight over logic and experience for the revelation of the deepest truths. Okay? That's why Melville and Hawthorne were called the anti-transcendentalists. They didn't necessarily believe in the innate goodness of people. However, Seward's meaning is most likely referring to Immanuel Kant, who considered transcendental idealism, and he's using transcendental here as in opposition to empirical. So transcendental idealism instead of empirical proof. He said, the chief precept of transcendental idealism is that knowledge is based on subjective existence rather than on experience. That is, that the self or the ego uses sense perceptions to build stores of knowledge. At one point in the narrative, you're going to hear Godalming ask about whether they can hire a special. And what he means when he says the word special is special. No, he's actually talking about hiring a smaller dedicated train to take them where they need to go. Think about that. That's like hiring a limo. You know, you get a engine with a car, a sleeper car or whatever, something lightweight, and you get the right of way on the track. People have to clear off onto the side rails. You get to go ahead and you pay for the whole thing. It wasn't crazy expensive for someone like Godalming, and it could be done. And that was something he would have been able to do in the UK. So that's one of the things that Godalming is talking about. There's a little bit of Latin bandied about in this particular chapter. One of them, and of course I'm going to butcher it, but I'll get the point across. A particulari ad universale, which in Latin means from the particular to the universal. So it's about making a generalization based on some amount of fact. You're looking at a particular situation and you make a universal conclusion based on that. There's also two people who their names are just kind of tossed out there. For us, it would be like saying Freud and Jung. You know, it's two names that people would have known. They were criminologists, and they studied kind of criminal psychology. So they were doctors. And one of the things that Lombroso, this is one of the names, believed was that individuals who were engaged in criminal acts, not by choice, but because they were quote-unquote atavistic and had never evolved past the uncivilized nature of their primitive forebears, that's why people committed crimes. They are savages in the middle of civilization. Now, atavism is a tendency to revert to an ancestral type. So it's like an evolutionary throwback, or it's something characterized by a reversion to something ancestral or something ancient. So it's this idea of, you know, going all primal and becoming a savage again. So the 1888 Encyclopedia Britannica, 9th edition, refers to such individuals as men, quote, who live in the midst of our civilization as mere savages. The existing system of law can scarcely be brought to distinguish them from criminals. Moralists attribute to atavism a large number of offenses, which lawyers attribute to guilty dispositions. But the Britannica editor appears skeptical of this view. He goes on and says, it is not, however, owing to atavism, but to the mere continuance of an old order of things that so many of our ill-educated classes, shepherds, agricultural laborers, and even factory hands, are as little developed and live a life as little intellectual as savages. latent in our small hamlets and large cities, there is more savagery than many reformers are aware of, and it needs but little experience to discover something of the old barbarity lurking still in the minds and hearts under a thin veil of civilization.
Hmm.
Goodness. And that was in the Encyclopedia Britannica. Lomboso pointed to certain physical and mental abnormalities of those quote-unquote born criminals, such as, and this gets really interesting, skull size and asymmetry of the face and other body parts. We've talked before about how pretty equals pure or good, and ugly or deformed equals bad or evil. And here you have criminologists saying that the size of your skull and an asymmetrical face are indicative of your criminal, latent, inherent criminal nature. Now, I read a few years ago, there was an article on beauty and that symmetry equals beauty. And so they took a bunch of movie stars' faces to figure out who had the most symmetrical face. You want to know who? Denzel Washington. There's a reason why I've always had a crush on this guy. So Denzel has basically like the perfect face. So fine. Here's where I think it just gets freaky. The skull size thing. If you go and you read Stephen Jay Gould's book, The Mismeasure of Man, there were these horrible tests that were used to prove that skull size equated intelligence. And it goes right back to what this guy Lombroso is saying. It's the idea that intelligence and skull size and all of those factors would inherently mean you were better, like you, more capable of doing good, that you would only do good, and that you would be a superior being. Well, in these old flawed tests, one of the things they did is they took a skull of a Caucasian and a skull of an African. I think the test was actually done in England. And they put BBs inside the skull and then tamped the BBs down to see how many they could pack inside. Stephen Jay Gould went ahead and replicated these tests. And beyond a question, beyond a shadow of the doubt, he was able to prove conclusively that the scientists had just kind of tamped down a little harder on the BBs in the white skull. I mean, it's stuff like this that just, oh my gosh, it just kind of makes me nuts. But I think it is so interesting to see how our ability to understand people and right and wrong and good and bad has morphed over time. You know, there are statements that we make to each other about people and judgments that we make about people that we are so sure that we're right about. And who knows what they're going to discover next? Oh, it's just so fascinating. So anyway, this idea of being a born criminal, because of the skull size and stuff. The next sentence in the annotation said, his views have since been discredited, right? But Lombroso's role in bringing science to the study of criminal behavior is regarded as pivotal. Okay. Now, Nordau, who's the other name that's thrown about, he was a Hungarian physician, author, and critic. He adapted those original views of inherited degeneracy. This is more than ghosts. This is more than Ibsen's The Sins of the Father Are Visited on the Son. This is you're genetically destined to be a criminal. He concluded that various artists of the 19th century were victims of decaying brains and labeled their art as, wait for it, degenerate. Did you ever see the degenerate art exhibit? The stuff that the Nazis called degenerate? Oh, it's fascinating. Really amazing art. Anyway, so Nordau, he characterized, for example, Baudelaire as showing, quote, all the mental stigma of degeneration during the whole of his life, and termed Rossetti and Verlaine imbeciles, Swinburne a criminal, and Wagner a crazed graphomaniac. Although, ironically, Nordau was an early Zionist leader, his thinking was readily adopted by the Nazi regime, which began in 1937 to purge German museums of quote-unquote degenerate art. With the demise of Lombroso's scientific theories, Nordau's pseudoscientific criticism of art suffered the same fate. And all of this ties into the same period when Dracula was being written. How cool is that? I love this stuff. I'm gonna see if I can find degenerate art on the web, or a link to the original degenerate art exhibit. And if I can, I will post a link to it, because the art, it was Klimt and Klee and Chagall, you know, all of the artists you'd expect to be purged. Beautiful stuff. Some really beautiful stuff. And more beautiful stuff is our chapter today. So without any further ado, and reminding you, I will catch you on the flip side, because there's two things that I need to read to you. I turn you over into the capable hands of our readers today for chapter 25 of Dracula.
Dr. Seward's Diary, 11 October, evening.
Jonathan Harker has asked me to note this, as he says he is hardly equal to the task, and he wants an exact record kept. I think that none of us were surprised when we were asked to see Mrs. Harker a little before the time of sunset. We have of late come to understand that sunrise and sunset are to her times of peculiar freedom, when her old self can be manifest without any controlling force subduing or restraining her or inciting her to action. This mood or condition begins some half hour or more before actual sunrise or sunset, and lasts till either the sun is high or whilst the clouds are still aglow with the rays streaming above the horizon. At first, there is a sort of negative condition, as if some tie were loosened, and then the absolute freedom quickly follows. When, however, the freedom ceases, the change back or relapse comes quickly, preceded only by a spell of warning silence. Tonight, when we met, she was somewhat constrained and bore all the signs of an internal struggle. I put it down myself to her making a violent effort at the earliest instant she could do so. A very few minutes, however, gave her complete control of herself. Then, motioning her husband to sit beside her on the sofa where she was half reclining, she made the rest of us bring chairs up close. Taking her husband's hand in hers, she began. "We are all here together in freedom for perhaps the last time. I know that you will always be with me to the end." This was to her husband, whose hand had, as we could see, tightened upon her. "In the morning we go out upon our task, and God alone knows what may be in store for any of us. You are going to be so good to me to take me with you. I know that all that brave, earnest men can do for a poor, weak woman whose soul perhaps is lost, no, not yet, but is at any rate at stake, you will do. But you must remember that I am not as you are. There is a poison in my blood, in my soul, which may destroy me, which must destroy me unless some relief comes to us. Oh, my friends, you know, as well as I do, that my soul is at stake. And though I know there is one way out for me, you must not, and I must not, take it." She looked appealingly to us all, in turn, beginning and ending with her husband. "What is that way?" asked Van Helsing in a hoarse voice. "What is that way which we must not, may not, take? That I may die now, either by my own hand or that of another, before the greater evil is entirely wrought. I know, and you know, that were I once dead, you could and would set free my immortal spirit, even as you did my poor Lucy's. Were death, or the fear of death, the only thing that stood in the way, I would not shrink to die here now amidst the friends who love me. But death is not all. I cannot believe that to die in such a case, when there is hope before us and a bitter task to be done, is God's will. Therefore, I, on my part, give up here the certainty of eternal rest, and go out into the dark where may be the blackest things that the world or the nether world holds." We were all silent, for we knew instinctively that this was only a prelude. The faces of the others were set, and Harker's grew ashen gray. Perhaps he guessed better than any of us what was coming. She continued, "This is what I can give into the hotchpot." I could not but note the quaint legal phrase which she used in such a place, and with all seriousness. "What will each of you give? Your lives, I know," she went on quickly. "That is easy for brave men. Your lives are God's, and you can give them back to him. But what will you give to me?" She looked again questioningly, but this time avoided her husband's face. Quincy seemed to understand. He nodded, and her face lit up. "Then I shall tell you plainly what I want, for there must be no doubtful matter in this connection between us now. You must promise me, one and all, even you, my beloved husband, that should the time come, you will kill me." "What is that time?" The voice was Quincy's, but it was low and strained. "When you shall be convinced that I am so changed that it is better that I die that I may live. When I am thus dead in the flesh, Then you will, without a moment's delay, drive a stake through me and cut off my head, or do whatever else may be wanting to give me rest. Quincy was the first to rise after the pause. He knelt down before her, and taking her hand in his, said solemnly, I'm only a rough fella, who hasn't perhaps lived as a man should to win such a distinction, but I swear to you by all that I hold sacred and dear, that should the time ever come, I shall not flinch from the duty that you have set us. And I promise you, too, that I shall make all certain, for if I am only doubtful, I shall take it that the time has come. My true friend, was all she could say amid her fast-falling tears, as bending over, she kissed his hand. I swear to say, my dear Madam Mina, said Van Helsing. And I, said Lord Godalming, each of them in turn kneeling to her to take the oath. I followed myself. Then her husband turned to her, wan-eyed and with a greenish pallor which subdued the snowy whiteness of his hair, and asked, And must I, too, make such a promise, O my wife? You too, my dearest, she said, with infinite yearning of pity in her voice and eyes. You must not shrink. You are nearest and dearest, and all the world to me. Our souls are knit into one, for all life and all time. Think, dear, that there have been times when brave men have killed their wives and their womankind to keep them from falling into the hands of the enemy. Their hands did not falter any the more, because those that they loved implored them to slay them. It is men's duty towards those whom they love in such times of sore trial. And, oh, my dear, if it is to be that I must meet death at any hand, let it be at the hand of him that loves me dearest. Dr. Van Helsing, I have not forgotten your mercy in poor Lucy's case to him who loved. She stopped with a flying blush and changed her phrase. To him who had best right to give her peace. If that time shall come again, I look to you to make it a happy memory of my husband's life, that it was his loving hand which set me free from the awful thrall upon me. Again, I swear, came the professor's resonant voice. Mrs. Harker smiled, positively smiled, as with a sigh of relief she leaned back and said, And now, one word of warning, a warning which you must never forget. This time, if it ever come, may come quickly and unexpectedly, and in such case you must lose no time in using your opportunity. At such a time I myself might be, nay, if the time ever come shall be, leagued with your enemy against you. One more request. She became very solemn as she said this. It is not vital and necessary like the other, but I want you to do one thing for me, if you will. We all acquiesced, but no one spoke. There was no need to speak. I want you to read the burial service. She was interrupted by a deep groan from her husband. Taking his hand in hers, she held it over her heart and continued, You must read it over me some day. Whatever may be the issue of all this fearful state of things, it will be a sweet thought to all or some of us. You, my dearest, will, I hope, read it, for then it will be in your voice, in my memory forever, come what may. But, oh, my dear one, he pleaded, death is far off from you. Nay, she said, holding up a warning hand, I am deeper in death at this moment than if the weight of an earthly grave lay heavy upon me. Oh, my wife, must I read it, he said before he began. It would comfort me, my husband, was all she said, and he began to read when she had got the book ready. How can I? How could anyone tell of that strange scene, its solemnity, its gloom, its sadness, its horror, and withal its sweetness? Even a skeptic, who can see nothing but a travesty of bitter truth in anything holy or emotional, would have been melted to the heart had he seen that little group of loving and devoted friends kneeling round that stricken and sorrowing lady, or heard the tender passion of her husband's voice as in tones so broken and emotional that often he had to pause. He read the simple and beautiful service from the burial of the dead. I cannot go on. Words and voice fail me. She was right in her instinct. Strange as it was, bizarre as it may hereafter seem even to us who felt its potent influence at the time, it comforted us much, and the silence which showed Mrs. Harker's coming relapse from her freedom of soul did not seem so full of despair to any of us as we had dreaded.
Jonathan Harker's Journal. 15th of October, Varna. We left Charing Cross on the morning of the 12th, got to Paris the same night and took the places secured for us in the Orient Express. We travelled day and night, arriving here at about 5 o'clock. Lord Godalming went to the consulate to see if any telegram had arrived for him, whilst the rest of us came on to this hotel, the Odessus. The journey may have had incidents. I was, however, too eager to get on to care for them. Until the Tsarina Catherine comes into port, there will be no interest for me in anything in the wide world. Thank God Mina is well, and looks to be getting stronger. Her colour is coming back. She sleeps a great deal. Throughout the journey, she slept nearly all the time. Before sunrise and sunset, however, she is very wakeful and alert, and it has become a habit for Van Helsing to hypnotise her at such times. At first, some effort were needed, and he had to make many passes. But now she seems to yield at once, as if by habit, and scarcely any action is needed. He seems to have power at these particular moments, to simply will, and her thoughts obey him. He always asks her what she can see and hear. She answers to the first, "Nothing. All is dark." And to the second, "I can hear the waves lapping against the ship, and the water rushing by. Canvas and cordage strain, and masts and yards creak. The wind is high. I can hear it in the shrouds, and the bow throws back the foam." It is evident that the Tsarina Catherine is still at sea, hastening on her way to Varna. Lord Godalming has just returned. He had 4 telegrams, one each day since we started, and all to the same effect, that the Tsarina Catherine has not been reported to Lloyd's from anywhere. He had arranged before leaving London that his agent should send him every day a telegram saying if the ship had been reported. He was to have a message even if she were not reported, so that he might be sure that there was a watch being kept at the other end of the wire. We had dinner and went to bed early. Tomorrow we are to see the Vice Consul and to arrange, if we can, about getting on board the ship as soon as she arrives. Van Helsing says that our chance will be to get on board between sunrise and sunset. The Count, even if he takes the form of a bat, cannot cross the running water of his own volition, and so cannot leave the ship. As he dare not change to man's form without suspicion, which he evidently wishes to avoid, he must remain in the box. If, then, we can come on board after sunrise, he is at our mercy, for we can open the box and make sure of him, as we did of poor Lucy, before he wakes. What mercy he will get from us will not count for much. We think that we shall not have much trouble with officials or the seamen. Thank God, this is the country where bribery can do anything, and we are well supplied with money. We have only to make sure that the ship cannot come into port between sunset and sunrise without our being warned, and we shall be safe. Judge Moneybag will settle this case, I think. 16th of October. Mina's report still the same. Lapping waves and rushing water, darkness and favouring winds. We are evidently in good time, and when we hear of the Tsarina Catherine, we shall be ready. As she must pass the Dardanelles, we are sure to have some report. 17th of October. Everything is pretty well fixed now, I think, to welcome the Count on his return from his tour. Godalming told the shippers that he fancied that the box sent aboard might contain something stolen from a friend of his, and got a half-consent that he might open it at his own risk. The owner gave him a paper telling the captain to give him every facility in doing whatever he chose on board the ship, and also a similar authorization to his agent at Varna. We have seen the agent, who was much impressed with Godalming's kindly manner to him, and we are all satisfied that whatever he can do to aid our wishes will be done. We have already arranged what to do in case we get the box open. If the Count is there, Van Helsing and Seward will cut off his head at once and drive a stake through his heart. Morrison Godalming and I shall prevent interference even if we have to use the arms which we shall have ready. The Professor says that if we can so treat the Count's body, it will soon after fall into dust. In such case there would be no evidence against us, in case any suspicion of murder were aroused. But even if it did not, we should stand or fall by our act, and perhaps some day this very script may be evidence to come between some of us and a rope. For myself, I should take the chance only too thankfully if it were to come. We mean to leave no stone unturned to carry out our intent. We have arranged with certain officials that the instant the Tsarina Catherine is seen, we are to be informed by a special messenger. 24th of October. A whole week of waiting. Daily telegrams to Godalming, but only the same story. Not yet reported. Mina's hypnotic answer is unvaried. Lapping waves, rushing water, and creaking masts.
Telegram, Rufus Smith, Lloyd's London to Lord Godalming. Care of HBM Vice Consul Varna. October 24. Czarina Catherine reported this morning from Dardanelle.
Dr. Seward's Diary, 25 October. How I miss my phonograph. To write a diary with a pen is irksome to me, but Van Helsing says I must. We were all wild with excitement yesterday when Godalming got his telegram from Lloyd's. I know now what men feel in battle when the call to action is heard. Mrs. Harker alone of our party did not show any signs of emotion. After all, it is not strange that she did not, for we took special care not to let her know anything about it, and we all tried not to show any excitement when we were in her presence. In old days she would, I'm sure, have noticed, no matter how we might have tried to conceal it. But in this way she is greatly changed during the past 3 weeks. The lethargy grows upon her, and though she seems strong and well, and is getting back some of her color, Van Helsing and I are not satisfied. We talk of her often. We have not, however, said a word to the others. It would break poor Harker's heart, certainly his nerve, if he knew that we had even a suspicion on the subject. Van Helsing examines, he tells me, her teeth very carefully whilst she is in the hypnotic condition, for he says that so long as they do not begin to sharpen, there is no active danger of a change in her. If this change should come, it would be necessary to take steps. We both know what those steps would have to be, though we do not mention our thoughts to each other. We should neither of us shrink from the task, awful though it be to contemplate. Euthanasia is an excellent and comforting word. I am grateful to whoever invented it. It is only about 24 hours' sail from the Dardanelles to here, at the rate the Czarina Catherine has come from London. She should, therefore, arrive some time in the morning, but as she cannot possibly get in before noon, we are all about to retire early. We shall get up at 1 o'clock, so as to be ready. 25 October, noon. No news yet of the ship's arrival. Mrs. Harker's hypnotic report this morning was the same as usual, so it is possible that we may get news at any moment. We men are all in a fervor of excitement, except Harker, who is calm. His hands are cold as ice, and an hour ago I found him wetting the edge of the great Kukri knife which he now always carries with him. It will be a bad lookout for the Count if the edge of that Kukri ever touch his throat, driven by that stern, ice-cold hand. Van Helsing and I were a little alarmed about Mrs. Harker today. About noon she got into a sort of lethargy which we did not like. Although we kept silent to the others, we were neither of us happy about it. She had been restless all the morning, so that we were at first glad to know that she was sleeping. When, however, her husband mentioned casually that she was sleeping so soundly that he could not wake her, we went to her room to see for ourselves. She was breathing naturally and looked so well and peaceful that we agreed that the sleep was better for her than anything else. Poor girl, she has so much to forget that it is no wonder that sleep, if it brings oblivion to her, does her good. Later, our opinion was justified, for when, after a refreshing sleep of some hours, she woke up, she seemed brighter and better than she had been for days. At sunset, she made the usual hypnotic report. Wherever he may be in the Black Sea, the Count is hurrying to his destination. To his doom, I trust. 26 October. Another day and no tidings of the Czarina Catherine. She ought to be here by now. That she is still journeying somewhere is apparent, for Mrs. Harker's hypnotic report at sunrise was still the same. It is possible that the vessel may be lying by at times for fog. Some of the steamers which came in last evening reported patches of fog both to north and south of the port. We must continue our watching, as the ship may now be signaled at any moment. 27 October, noon. Most strange. No news yet of the ship we wait for. Mrs. Harker reported last night and this morning, as usual, lapping waves and rushing water, though she added that the waves were very faint. The telegrams from London have been the same. No further report. Van Helsing is terribly anxious and told me just now that he fears the Count is escaping us. He added significantly, I did not like that lethargy of Madame Mina's. Souls and memories can do strange things during trance. I was about to ask him more, but Harker just then came in and he held up a warning hand. We must try at sunset to make her speak more fully when in her hypnotic state.
Telegram, Rufus Smith, London, to Lord Godalming, care of HBM Vice Consul Varna. October 28, Tsarina Catherine reported entering Galatz at 1 o'clock today.
Dr. Seward's Diary, 28 October. When the telegram came announcing the arrival in Galatz, I do not think it was such a shock to any of us as might have been expected. True, we did not know whence or how or when the bolt would come, but I think we all expected that something strange would happen. The day of arrival at Varna made us individually satisfied that things would not be just as we had expected. We only waited to learn where the change would occur. Nonetheless, however, it was a surprise. I suppose that nature works on such a hopeful basis that we believe against ourselves that things will be as they ought to be, not as we should know that they will be. Transcendentalism is a beacon to the angels, even if it be a will-o'-the-wisp to man. Van Helsing raised his hand over his head for a moment, as though in remonstrance with the Almighty, but he said not a word, and in a few seconds stood up with his face sternly set. Lord Godalming grew very pale and sat breathing heavily. I was myself half stunned and looked in wonder at one after another. Quincy Morris tightened his belt with his quick movement, which I knew so well. In our old wandering days it meant action. Mrs. Harker grew ghastly white, so that the scar on her forehead seemed to burn, but she folded her hands meekly and looked up in prayer. Harker smiled, actually smiled, the dark, bitter smile of one who is without hope, but at the same time his action belied his words, for his hands instinctively sought the hilt of the great kukri knife and rested there. "Ventos to next train start for Galatz," said Van Helsing to us generally, "at 6:30 tomorrow morning." We all started, for the answer came from Mrs. Harker. "How on earth do you know that?" said Art. "You forget, or perhaps you do not know, though Jonathan does, and so does Dr. Van Helsing, that I am the train fiend. At home in Exeter, I always used to make up the timetable so as to be helpful to my husband. I found it so useful sometimes that I always make a study of the timetables now. I knew that if anything were to take us to Castle Dracula, we should go by Galatz, or at any rate through Bucharest, so I learned the times very carefully. Unhappily, there are not many to learn, as the only train tomorrow leaves, as I say." "Wonderful woman," murmured the professor. "Can't we get a special?" asked Lord Godalming. Van Helsing shook his head. "I fear not. This land is very different from yours or mine. Even if we did have a special, it would probably not arrive as soon as our regular train. Moreover, we have something to prepare. We must think. Now, let us organize. You, friend Arthur, go to the train and get the tickets and arrange that all be ready for us to go in the morning. Do you, friend Jonathan, go to the agent of the ship and get from him letters to the agent in Galatz with authority to make a search of the ship just as it was here. Quincy Morris, you see the vice consul and get his aid with his fellow in Galatz and all he can do to make our way smooth so that no times be lost when over the Danube. John will stay with Madame Mina and me and we shall consult. For if time be long, you may be delayed, and it will not matter when the sun set, since I am here with Madame Mina to make report." "And I," said Mrs. Harker brightly, and more like her old self than she had been for many a long day, "shall try to be of use in all ways, and shall think and write for you as I used to do. Something is shifting from me in some strange way, and I feel freer than I have been of late." The three younger men looked happier at the moment as they seemed to realize the significance of her words, but Van Helsing and I, turning to each other, met each a grave and troubled glance. We said nothing at the moment, however. When the three men had gone out to their tasks, Van Helsing asked Mrs. Harker to look up the copy of the diaries and find him the part of Harker's journal at the castle. She went away to get it. When the door was shut upon her, he said to me, "We mean the same. Speak out. Here is some change. It is a hope that makes me sick, for it may deceive us." "Quite so. Do you know why I asked her to get the manuscript?" "No," said I, "unless it was to get an opportunity of seeing me alone." "You are in part right, friend John, but only in part. I want to tell you something. And oh, my friend, I am taking a great, a terrible risk. But I believe it is right. In the moment when Madame Mina said those words that arrest both our understanding, an inspiration came to me. In the trance of 3 days ago, The Count sent her his spirit to read her mind. Or, more like, he took her to see him in his earthen box, in the ship with water rushing, just as it go free at rise and set of sun. He learned then that we are here, for she have more to tell in her open life, with eyes to see, ears to hear, than he, shut as he is in his coffin box. Now he make his most effort to escape us. At present, he want her not. He is sure with his so great knowledge that she will come at his call. But he cut her off, take her, as he can do, out of his own power, that so she come not to him. Ah, dare I have hope that our man-brains that have been of man so long and that have not lost the grace of God will come higher than his child-brain that lie in his tomb for centuries, that grow not yet to our stature, and that do only work selfish and therefore small. Here comes Madam Mina. Not a word to her of her trance. She knows it not, and it would overwhelm her and make despair just when we want all her hope, all her courage, when most we want all her great brain, which is trained like man's brain, but is of sweet woman, and have a special power which the Count give her, and which he may not take away altogether, though he think not so. Hush, let me speak, and you shall learn. Oh, John, my friend, we are in awful straits. I fear as I never feared before. We can only trust the good God. Silence. Here she comes. I thought that the professor was going to break down and have hysterics, just as he had when Lucy died, but with a great effort he controlled himself and was at perfect nervous poise when Mrs. Harker tripped into the room, bright and happy-looking, and, in the doing of work, seemingly forgetful of her misery. As she came in, she handed a number of sheets of typewriting to Van Helsing. He looked over them gravely, his face brightening up as he read. Then, holding the pages between his finger and thumb, he said, "Friend John, to you with so much experience already, and you too, dear Madam Mina, that are young, here is a lesson. Do not fear ever to think. A half-thought has been buzzing often in my brain, but I fear to let him loose his wings. Here now, with more knowledge, I go back to where that half-thought come from, and I find that he be no half-thought at all. That be a whole thought, though so young that he is not yet strong to use his little wings. Nay, like the ugly duck of my friend Hans Andersen, he be no duck thought at all, but a big swan thought that sail nobly on big wings when the time come for him to try them. See, I read here what Jonathan have written. That other of his race who, in a large age, again and again brought his forces over the great river into Turkey land, who, when he was beaten back, came again and again and again, though he had to come alone from the bloody field where his troops were being slaughtered, since he knew that he alone could ultimately triumph. What does this tell us? Not much, no. The Count's child thought see nothing, therefore he speaks so free. Your man thought see nothing. My man thought see nothing till just now, no. But there comes another word from someone who speak without thought, because she too know not what it mean, what it might mean. Just as there are elements which rest, yet when in nature's course they move on their way and they touch, then poof, and there comes a flash of light, heaven-wide, that blind and kill and destroy some, but that show up all earth below for leagues and leagues. Is it not so? Well, I shall explain. To begin, have you ever studied the philosophy of crime? Yes and no. You, John, yes, for it is a study of insanity. You, no, Madam Mina, for crime touch you not but once. Still, your mind works true and argues not a particulari ad universale. There is this particularity in criminals. It is so constant in all countries and at all times that even police, who know not much from philosophy, come to know it empirically that it is. That is to be empiric. The criminal always work at one crime. That is the true criminal who seems predestined to crime and who will of none other. This criminal has not full man brain. He is clever and cunning and resourceful, but he be not of man stature as to brain. he be of child brain in much. Now, this criminal of ours is predestined to crime also. He too have child brain, and it is of the child to do what he have done. The little bird, the little fish, the little animal learn not by principle, but empirically. And when he learn to do, then there is to him the ground to start from to do more. Dos posto, said Archimedes, give me a fulcrum and I shall move the world. To do once is the fulcrum whereby child brain become man brain. And until he have the purpose to do more, he continue to do the same again every time, just as he have done before. Oh, my dear, I see that your eyes are open and that you, the lightning flash, show all the leagues. For Mrs. Harker began to clap her hands and her eyes sparkled. He went on, now you shall speak. Tell us two dry men of science what you see with those so bright eyes. He took her hand and held it whilst she spoke. His finger and thumb closed on her pulse, as I thought instinctively and unconsciously as she spoke. The Count is a criminal and of criminal type. Nordau and Lombroso would so clarify him, and qua criminale, he is of an imperfectly formed mind. Thus, in a difficulty, he has to seek resources in habit. His past is a clue, and the one page of it that we know, and that from his own lips, tells that once before, when in what Mr. Morris would call a tight place, he went back to his own country from the land he had tried to invade, and thence, without losing purpose, prepared himself for a new effort. He came again better equipped for his work, and won. So he came to London to invade a new land. He was beaten, and when all hope of success was lost, and his existence in danger, he fled back over the sea to his home, just as formerly he had fled back over the Danube from Turkeyland. Good, good, oh, you so clever lady, said Van Helsing enthusiastically, as he stopped and kissed her hand. A moment later he said to me, as calmly as though we had been having a sick-room consultation, 72 only, and in all this excitement, I have hope. Turning to her again, he said with keen expectation, but go on, go on. There is more to tell, if you will. Be not afraid. John and I know. I do, in any case, and shall tell you if you are right. Speak without fear. I will try to, but you will forgive me if I seem too egotistical. Nay, fear not. You must be egotist, for it is of you that we think. Then, as he is criminal, he is selfish. And as his intellect is small and his action is based on selfishness, he confines himself to one purpose. That purpose is remorseless. As he fled back over the Danube, leaving his forces to be cut to pieces, so now he is intent on being safe, careless of all. So his own selfishness frees my soul somewhat from the terrible power which he acquired over me on that dreadful night. I felt it. Oh, I felt it. Thank God for his great mercy. My soul is freer than it has been since that awful hour, and all that haunts me is a fear lest in some trance or dream he may have used my knowledge for his ends. The professor stood up. He has so used your mind, and by it he has left us here in Varna, whilst the ship that carried him rushed through enveloping fog up to Gulz, where, doubtless, he had made preparation for escaping from us. But his child mind only saw so far. And it may be that, as ever is in God's providence, the very thing that the evildoer most reckoned on for his selfish good turns out to be his chiefest harm. The hunter is taken in his own snare, as the great psalmist says. For now that he think he is free from every trace of us all, and that he has escaped us with so many hours to him, then his selfish child brain will whisper him to sleep. He think, too, that as he cut himself off from knowing your mind, there can be no knowledge of him to you. There is where he fail. That terrible baptism of blood which he gave you makes you free to go to him in spirit, as you have as yet done in your times of freedom when the sun rise and set. At such times you go by my volition and not by his. And this power to good of you and others you have won from your suffering at his hands. This is now all more precious that he know it not. and to God himself, have even cut himself off from knowledge of our where. We, however, are not selfish, and we believe that God is with us through all this blackness and these many dark hours. We shall follow him, and we shall not flinch, even if we peril ourselves that we become like him. Friend John, this has been a great hour, and it have done much to advance us on our way. You must be scribe and write him all down, so that when the others return from their work, you can give it to them, then they shall know as we do. And so I have written it whilst we wait their return, and Mrs. Harker has written with the typewriter all since she brought the MS to us.
And in this situation, MS stands for manuscript. So, first, before I forget, a huge thanks to John Scholes, because without even bothering me, he had a friend record the telegrams for us, which were marvelous.
Well read.
And that was just a huge gift. I wasn't thinking far enough ahead. So, Mina's looking better. What a surprise. Were you not as worried as I was that they had once again completely muffed it? It seems, though, that the explanations that we get from Van Helsing and Mina at the end of this chapter do fit. Dracula knows, he's afraid, he created the fog, he got away. Now, I put the map that we got from Siri James, the writer who wrote Dracula, My Love, I put the map back up because now you can see Galatz and you can see Varna and you can see their travel route. And that I find to be very helpful. Maybe it's being the daughter of a geographer, but I like maps. Now, were you a little surprised about Seward's, you know, thank God for euthanasia? What a great word. I was a little surprised by that, mostly because I didn't really think it was a topic, but evidently it was. If you don't know, euthanasia comes from EU, which means good in Greek, and Thanatos, which means death. And there's a famous poem called Thanatos as well, or Thanatosis. So the idea is a painless death. And there's a very interesting thing that's in the annotations that I'm going to read to you. The ethical and legal issue involved is by no means new. In 1881, journalist Richard Roe in Life in the London Streets considered the homeless of London, and this is what he wrote. But are such lives, lives that ought to be, must be, led? I cannot believe it. We shoot old horses when they have become a weariness to themselves. If we cannot help our pariahs, it would be a kindness, I think, to kill them off, to hand them over in that way to the tender mercies of the all-seeing one in whom we are so fond of bidding them to trust. But the pariah, first selected for this euthanasia, might probably object. Otherwise, he would have previously his own quietus taken. And the benevolent murderer would be strung up between the gloomy walls of a jail with a black flag flapping over him. So, I mean, even back in 1881, I mean, we know from A Modest Proposal by Jonathan Swift, which I will deal with when we do Gulliver, that this kind of an idea was not news, but I find the clinical nature of that passage to be shocking. Now, I will say, just to round out the argument, that when my grandfather was very, very ill at the end and he went into hospice, yes, I'm sure if he were on ER that they could have brought out a crash cart and they could have pumped him full of drugs and they could have brought him back. But what kind of life is that? I mean, he was on his way out. He was trying to go. He was done. And you got to respect that. And the people who I've met at hospices, they have this marvelous quality to them of being absolutely at peace with mortality. Or at least that's kind of how it seems to me. And I think it's important here because even though this chapter did have a lot of melodrama in it, Mina's statements about taking her own life or expecting one of the guys to stake her if she should show signs of having turned too far to be saved, I don't think that's melodramatic. It may have been stated melodramatically, but I don't think she has gone into this unthinkingly. And of course, Seward will have seen suffering on a very large scale in his work. And to him, like the statement about, you know, putting a horse out of his misery, or putting your dog down or your cat down, that not offering that same release to someone, it would seem kind of cruel. So, I don't know. But it's interesting that it's been around that long, and also interesting that Seward states it so blatantly, particularly knowing that other people are going to read the journal. Or, I mean, other people in their little crew of vampire hunters. And like Lincoln, Vampire Hunter, that movie's coming out soon. I kind of hope it's good. I don't know. There's something about me that just really gets a kick out of Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter. Anyway, the other thing that I wanted to read to you is the burial service. Why was Mina going on about this? Why was it that she wanted to hear the burial service? It seems to me that just like last rites in Catholicism, I remember hearing people talk about the relief of the last rites being given, because you know that you're okay with God as you head off into the great unknown. And Jews have the Kaddish, which we say, which, if you aren't familiar with it, it's not a prayer of the dead or for the dead. The word Kaddish just means sanctification, and it's the sanctification of God's name. It's like, it's almost like a hymn of praise. It's I don't know any other way to translate it like that. And so the speaking of the Kaddish, or the hearing of the last rites, are, when you are in that faith, a very settling thing. Well, let me read you the burial prayer, because you're going to hear lots of resonances, and you've heard so much of it before. But the interesting thing is that the Book of Common Prayer in England between 1662 and 1928 didn't change. So this sucker had been around for a long time, which means its resonances were felt everywhere, all the time. Anytime somebody died, you were going to hear this. So, and of course it would be died and were being buried in holy ground, because a church clergyman would be reading the prayer. So now you see why it mattered to Mina. Okay. It's very short. "I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet he shall live. And whosoever liveth and believeth in me shall never die. I know that my Redeemer liveth, and that he shall stand at the latter upon my death. And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I shall see for myself, and mine eyes shall behold, and not another. We brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." You can see why it mattered, right? So even though it feels like melodrama in the beginning, it's really, really lovely. And so on that note, I leave you for the week. The Craftlit/Defarge shop is open. We have new stuff in the store. T-shirts, messenger bags, coffee mugs, all sorts of fun stuff. Links to new patterns. And don't forget the iPhone iTouch Droid app. Working on some extras for that as well. And then they'll be released to everyone. Also, the February incentive, caramels and embroidery. Pictures of the embroidery are on the website at craftlit.com. I think that's everything. It'll be March when I talk to you next, won't it? Holy smoke. Happy Leap Day when it comes, and have a great week. I'll talk to you soon. Bye. Please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Visit knitcircus.com and sign up for your free e-newsletter. And What Would Madame Defarge Knit? A new book of knit and crochet patterns coming to you from the Craftlit family. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craftlit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found
at craftlit.com. Craftlit can also be accessed by its own Android and iPhone application. You can purchase it at the iPhone or iTouch application store, or you can subscribe free at iTunes. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.